Here are all the John Lothian News daily updates from the week of September 4th, 2020. Enjoy. It's August 31st, 2020, and this is the John Lothian News daily update. And now, John Lothian with hits and takes.
This is John Lothian with hits and takes from the John Lothian newsletter. I received a note Friday afternoon from a One Chicago executive with the August 14th notice the exchange was going to close. I was surprised and embarrassed all at once that I had missed this news from a week before. As I wrote in a story posted to johnlothiannews.com, the creation of One Chicago in single stock futures helped drive the development and the popularity of this newsletter. I am still a believer in the potential for single stock futures, though the obstacles to success still are tough. I do expect we shall see some people get back into this sector. I have always said ownership matters, and One Chicago just had the wrong ownership configuration and grouping. Speaking of One Chicago, former One Chicago executive Peter Borish was featured on the podcast The Rabbi's Husband. The subject of his chat was Leviticus chapter 25, verses 35 to 38, no standing by. Borish talks about how his prediction of the stock market crash of 1987 helped create the charity Robinhood, and more. The CME today announced the launch of options on its Micro E-mini S&P 500 and Micro E-mini NASDAQ 100 futures contracts. Some of the notable stories and notices of the day are 10 years Eurex and Korea Exchange, a prime example of a successful partnership from Eurex. Berkshire Hathaway buys stakes valued at a total of $6 billion in 5 Japanese trading companies. TikTok deal talks are slowed over new China rules. And world's richest people smashed wealth records this week. Oliver Frischmeier, the head of corporate engagement and executive services at Deutsche Börse, is celebrating his 10th anniversary at the exchange. He started as a student assistant and worked his way up. Congratulations, Oliver. The valuation of Chicago's Palmer House Hotel is 45% lower than it was 2 years ago, indicating how much the pandemic has impacted the hospitality sector. The New Zealand Exchange is trading normally today despite new cyber attacks, it reports. However, the New Zealand Exchange website is still offline and still under attack. The slowdown in air traffic has left one of United Airlines' snack suppliers with 15 tons of high-quality mixed nuts. If you want some nuts at a good price, now is your chance. Also, United Airlines dropped its $200 flight transfer fee. American Airlines is cutting its October flights by 55% versus last year and cutting 15 cities because of the pandemic. iHodl.com has a story that the Winklevoss forecast Bitcoin to reach $500,000. By the same token, the magazine I Am Shameless predicts I will be the most handsome man of 2020. Have a great day and stay safe, and treat people the same way you want to be treated, with respect, equality, and justice.
And now, first read. There's a new episode of The Spread Out, The Spread Running Hot, by Matt Rabel. This week on The Spread, the Fed opts for higher inflation targets, the OCC gets featured, CBO has a new options product, and more. To watch The Spread, go to johnlothiannews.com. There's a story in Barron's by Barney Frank and Christopher Giancarlo. Manipulation helped kill LIBOR. Its replacement needs to be stronger. This summer marks the 10th anniversary of the passage of the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, designed to address flaws and abuses that led to the 2008-2009 financial crisis. One of the authors of this opinion played a leading role in the law's drafting, the other in its subsequent implementation and enforcement. A comment by John Lothian, Barney and Chris is not the combination I would have put together. There is a Bloomberg article by Liu Wang. Female fund managers beat men at stock picks, Goldman. Female managers remain woefully underrepresented in the fund industry, but they're doing a better job picking stocks than their male counterparts, at least this year. Among some 500 large-cap U.S. mutual funds, those with at least one-third of manager positions held by women have beaten those with no women by 1 percentage point in 2020, as shown by data compiled by Goldman Sachs Group, Inc. That's a slight departure from the previous 3 years, when gender difference had little impact on fund performance. A comment by John Lothian, now we need more women traders.
There's a notice from Gate 39 Media that financial marketing agency Gate 39 ranks as one of Inc. 5000's fastest growing companies for 2020. Gate 39 Media's commitment to growing revenues for clients in financial and agricultural services has landed the firm on the prestigious list for 2020. Congratulations to Shane Stiles and his crew for this ranking. There's a story about how COVID-19 is scary. Japan Group offers coffins, chainsaws for stress release. It's a story from Reuters, and it says, finding the pandemic scary, a Japanese group is trying to take people's minds off COVID-19 by putting them in coffins surrounded by chainsaw-wielding zombies. Customers this weekend in Tokyo can lie in a 2-meter windowed box, listening to horror story, watching actors perform and getting poked with fake hands and squirted with water. Anything to get your mind off the pandemic, I guess. From Friday, our top stories from Friday's John Lothian newsletter was The Economist. In 20 years, exchanges have gone from clubby firms to huge conglomerates, something we have seen in many other industries. The second story was from Crane's Chicago Business, Don Wilson changes course on Gold Coast Landmark. And the third story is from Traders Magazine, will remote traders last the distance?
And now, some stories from John Lothian News, starting with two from John Lothian.
Here is today's story, One Chicago to Close on September 18th for trading. Long Live One Chicago by John Lothian. One Chicago was a name given to a security futures exchange that was an idea that never lived up to its name. It was initially a collaboration between the CME, CBOE, and CBOT. Security Futures Exchange One Chicago put out a notice to its members on August 14th that it would wind down trading operations and stop them entirely September 18th. The collaboration between the CME Group, CBOE Global Markets, and Interactive Brokers ultimately fell apart after 19 years. The joint venture effort, imagined as a battle between Chicago, a derivatives capital, and New York, an equities capital, is relevant today based on the changes to the industry, the markets, and the firms themselves. However, adding a security futures exchange arm to the partner firms of 2020 probably makes more sense than doing it collaboratively with competitors. We might just see one or more of the partners start a new securities futures exchange as a go-alone effort. The CBOE and the CME Group have little reason to work together today to make One Chicago work, and probably even more reason to start their own security futures exchanges. Think about the world of 2001. The Commodity Futures Modernization Act was being implemented, and security futures were finally legal after being outlawed by the Shad-Johnson Accord. Back in 2001, CBOE Global Markets was the Chicago Board Options Exchange and was only an equity options exchange. The VIX and its futures were years in the future. The CME was ascendant based on the shift in interest rates towards the short end of the curve, the growing popularity of its E-mini S&P contract, and its improving Globex system. The CBOT was an afterthought for the One Chicago joint venture and was only added at the last minute of the deal. Its logo didn't even make it onto the banner displayed at the press conference announcing the joint venture. The imagined battle was between Chicago and New York for equities trading, but it was the internal rivalries and self-interest of the firms involved with security futures that held the venture back. I will always remember then CBOE chairman and CEO Bill Brodsky going on CNBC to talk about the new venture, and all he could do was talk about equity option trading. He said little to nothing about security futures. It was not New York that held single stock futures back. It was protecting existing business lines. Both CBOE and NASDAQ were guilty of this. One Chicago was initially competing against a venture from NASDAQ and Life called NASDAQ Life. Trading Technologies was originally supposed to be a partner in that deal, but was usurped by Life at the last minute as an electronic trading platform provider. NYSE in 2001 was the exchange and never entered into the U.S. security futures business, but it later merged with Euronext Life, which had single stock futures in Europe. Security futures were held back right out of the start by the margin protocol that put them on the same footing as equity options instead of being margin like other futures contracts. NASDAQ and CBOE had no interest in seeing single stock futures have structural advantages over their existing option businesses. The move to unwind the joint ventures rather than sell it or do a management buyout indicates that one or more of the partners is interested in launching their own separate security futures exchange. CBOE Global Markets is the most likely to do so as their management has become very aggressive since buying BATS. The case could be made for the CME Group to start a security futures exchange and offer stocks tied to commodities. Imagine trading crude oil futures and ExxonMobil single stock futures on the same platform. Both CBOE and CME are looking for growth. CME could be responding to signals that ICE is contemplating a U.S. security futures effort and wants to be able to respond more directly to the potential challenge by owning its own exchange outright and trading the products on Globex. With stock indexes at highs again, especially the popular FANG stocks, using leverage to manage equities positions via security futures might be a good solution for today's market paradigm. And maybe with the political muscle of CBOE Global Markets or CME Group behind this, rather than that of the meager One Chicago, the product will have more friends in Washington to help it compete against vested interest in the stock loan business. Maybe the 2000-2001 hype around single stock futures can be revived. I know I bear some responsibility for that hype as I was a big and vocal supporter of the product back then, even if I had a small but growing viral newsletter at the time. The battle between Chicago and New York is long gone. The One Chicago partnership is being unwound, but that does not mean we have heard the last of single stock futures. Here's the second story I wrote about One Chicago. The headline is One Chicago and Single Stock Futures Help Make the John Lothian Newsletter. The John Lothian Newsletter started in 2000 as a viral marketing experiment to help me grow my online brokerage business, but also my promotion of commodity trading advisors. That was the economic reasoning for starting at the time. However, the idea of single stock futures was also a driving reason for the creation of the newsletter and its virtual growth. At the time, I worked as an introducing broker. I did not know how single stock futures was going to impact the industry and its structure, but I had a sinking feeling that introducing brokers were going to be on the outside, the losing side of that. I needed a career hedge in case the introducing broker business was gravely harmed by the introduction of this long-desired product. Creating the newsletter would give me a higher visibility in the industry, helping me network with people I knew and people I would come to know. Ironically, one of the people I reached out to at the time about my future was the future CEO of One Chicago, David Downey. He was then at Interactive Brokers, which was a firm I figured would prosper from the collision of futures and securities world, as they had both already on their screens. Downey left Interactive Brokers suddenly after our first meeting, leaving the industry for personal reasons. So much for Plan A for a career move. Plan B was to grow the newsletter, which would not get a proper name until 2003. Back in 2000, I was promoting the work of Defender Capital Management and its owner John Maddy. There were other CTAs I was representing too, but I had the most success promoting Maddy. Of course, in 2007, Maddy would approach me for a job, and that led to the creation of MarketsWiki. Maddy's one trading program at the time traded U.S. 30-year Treasury bonds. He was the number one ranked CTA for a time for the last 3 years of the 700-plus CTAs the Price Futures Group was tracking at the time. there was good reason to promote his business, and I had modest success raising money for a guy trading from his basement in Portland, Oregon. Also in 2000, amid all the talk about single stock futures, I would attend any event that was going to discuss the product. I remember going to hear Bill Brodsky at an event at the Sears Tower. I remember complaining about the cost of one event and then being invited to moderate the whole event as a way to get in for free. Another time, after a CBOT Clearing Corporation executive pulled out of an event, I was asked to replace him to talk about straight-through processing in order to attend the event for free. It was there I met Bob Fitzsimmons of Nasdaq Life for the first time, and he introduced me to that exchange. Nasdaq Life was quick to see the value of my newsletter and its viralness and was an early ally in promoting it. I begged, swapped, and complained my way into these programs because at the time I was not yet really identified as a journalist. The concept of blogger was not yet in our lexicon, let alone where bloggers were not yet considered legitimate journalists, at least by other journalists. Back in 2000, I was blogging before blogging was called blogging. I was aggregating information and sharing it via email. I was putting my name on the subject line in front of the lead story so readers knew it was from me and not spam. That move turned John Lothian into a brand name. I was still John Lothian, but now there was another John Lothian entity. When I heard the CME, CBOE, and CBOT were going to hold a press conference to announce the creation of One Chicago, the notice said press with proper credentials should contact the CME for access to the event. I called corporate communications at the CME and talked to their then head, Ellen Resnick. I told her who I was and that I wanted to attend. I was told that the CME did not want writers from fringe publications that did not share the interests of the CME in attendance. I assured her I was a fringe publication, but that I did have the CME's interest in that of the other exchanges at heart and was a big supporter of single stock futures. I offered this deal at the time. I told her I would give her my wallet when I walked into the press conference, and if I opened my mouth, she could keep it. She let me in and did not ask for my wallet. It was at this press conference that I reunited with the new CME CEO, Jim McNulty. When I tried to remind him who I was, he didn't remember me. But then he did. McNulty had been helpful to me when I first graduated from college. He was nephew of Jim Hayes, the president of Hayes and Griffith Capital. Jim Hayes was a neighbor of Tom Cashman, my first employer and mentor. McNulty's hiring by the CME was another reason I started JLN, as I did not want to lose connection with people like him again as I was seeking higher industry visibility. My writing started to get noticed after the One Chicago announcement, as I was the only publication that was giving daily updates on the changes that were coming as a result of single stock futures. Of course, there was also the battle between open outcry and electronic trading going on, which I was writing about too. The move for single stock futures was a subset story of that war, as was all of the trading of single stock futures going to be electronic, not open outcry. Nasdaq Life was the early winner of the battle for single stock futures trading before the trading started. One Chicago did not even have a website, and Nasdaq Life had a dynamic startup culture brewing. I would even hire one of the employees of Nasdaq Life when I started MarketsWiki, the late Gail Osten. I always admired the startup culture that Nasdaq Life was able to create as a good example of the Innovator's Dilemma. The Innovator's Dilemma was a book by the late Harvard professor Clayton Christensen that David Downey said I had to read before he would talk to me more. I read the book and was immediately impacted by it. Downey left Interactive Brokers before I could read the book and get back to him. The book taught me the importance of culture and independence of startups from larger owners and stakeholders. I would make many friends, attract lots of readers, and make some enemies after the One Chicago announcement. I probably was too tough on One Chicago in those early days, but that kept them in the limelight while Nasdaq Life was dancing around me with developments. The old maxim, "There is no bad publicity to spell my name right," was the philosophy at the time for them. I was sorry to see One Chicago join the heap of decommissioned exchanges, but thankful for their existence and their impact on my life and work. That's all from John Lothian.
And now Tom Thompson with a story on hemp.
I've fallen and I can't get up. Hemp prices in 2020. This is Tom Thompson for John Lothian News. Our friends at Pan Exchange published their August 2020 hemp benchmarks and analysis last week. The harvest of field-grown industrial hemp has not only begun, but some early harvested hemp is already beginning to change hands. Pan Exchange reports that they have seen new crop CBD hemp trading at a premium to last year's. The premium for the new crop hemp reflects, at least in part, the risk that hemp's cannabinoid profile can deteriorate over time. Dominated by transactions for last year's crop, Pan Exchange's August price data show CBD stuck in the basement where it has been all year. There's still a large overhang of 2019 supply to work through. What's the outlook for the new crop? This year's industrial hemp was planted under the cloud of the economy-shaking coronavirus epidemic. In April, unemployment reached as high as 14.7%. It has not slid below 10% yet, let alone back below 4% where it began this year. Statistics for the first quarter of 2020 had shown a contraction in GDP of a bit more than 1% from the previous quarter, the fourth quarter of last year. But when producers were making their planting decisions during the second quarter, the economy was contracting even faster as GDP tumbled by 9% from the first quarter. By the way, you might remember even worse headlines for those first and second quarters, where GDP levels declined 5% and 35% respectively. Those numbers reflect the annualized rates of decline. Hemp for CBD, as well as for other industrial uses like fiber and grain, is too new a commodity for anyone to be able to predict the elasticity of its demand. That is, no one can tell how much the decline in personal incomes this year will affect the demand for CBD. The same goes for fiber and grain. The deepening uncertainty around demand would have been a critical factor in producers' planting decisions this year. With too much of the old crop still in inventory and CBD hemp prices stuck on low and facing huge unknowns about consumer attitudes about this new product, farmers planted less industrial hemp this spring. In fact, they seem to have planted many fewer acres. This is Econ 101, low prices signaling to farmers not to plant so much. For most parts of the country, this has been a great year for raising field crops, including hemp. But according to preliminary estimates from USDA's Farm Service Agency, the FSA, only 47,273 acres of industrial hemp were planted this year. This is less than a quarter of the total crop planted last year. Acreage devoted to CBD hemp fell the most compared to the final numbers from last year. This year, CBD constitutes a smaller share, only 64% of the total number of hemp acres. 27% of the acreage is for grain, and 9% is in fiber hemp. With the largest share of acreage, the CBD market drives the industrial hemp economy. But the prospects for CBD demand stabilizing anytime soon are remote. In a nutshell, it's hard to forecast what kind of demand will emerge for CBD in the legal cannabis channel. As a brand new consumer good, CBD's current popularity might turn out simply to be a fad. The prices for retail products containing CBD have fallen over the past 6 months, encouraging people to try CBD for the first time. Will their experiences be so good that they will persist as consumers? How about when prices rise? Furthermore, the increasingly intensive research into CBD's potential benefits will dampen demand if few of the wonder cannabinoids' claims are substantiated. And then there are the supply side effects from marijuana-based CBD that can be extracted without any THC from high THC strains of marijuana. As the market for legalized cannabis grows, its customers can often buy high CBD level products in dispensaries and recreational marijuana shops. People who first bought CBD at Walgreens now are increasingly buying it at legal marijuana shops. Marijuana CBD pressures industrial hemp CBD prices in states where both are available. Talk about the increasingly important hemp grain for a minute. Hemp grain is the seed of the hemp plant. It analogizes to soybeans in that the seeds can be consumed whole or they can be crushed into meal and oil, each finding its way into different products. It's also like soybeans in that it is suitable for both human and animal consumption. Intended for either market, hemp seed processing, transportation, and storage are critical and still at a very experimental stage. Hemp seeds have high oil content and are very susceptible to spoilage. The seeds themselves are thin-hulled and easy to damage. Hemp oil is pressed from seeds and usually has, at most, a trace amount of CBD or other cannabinoids. By the way, so-called CBD oil is just another neutral-tasting vegetable oil, like corn, olive, or canola oil, to which CBD extract has been added. Seeds themselves are high in nutrients, particularly protein and omega-3 fatty acids. They are often found in manufactured health foods like granola bars and mixed grain breakfast cereals. Ground hemp seeds are available at Whole Foods, for example, and the meal can be added as an ingredient by consumers into any variety of baked or cooked goods or stirred into yogurt. Hemp grain is slowly gaining use also as an animal feed. The main barrier to its acceptance is that as a new crop, relatively little research into the uses of whole hemp grain, meal, and oil has been published. It is currently being tested for inclusion in poultry and hog feeds. Thank you for listening. This is Tom Thompson for John Lothian News.
It's September 1st, 2020, and this is the John Lothian News Daily Update. Now here's John Lothian.
This is John Lothian with hits and takes from the John Lothian Newsletter. The FIA has published an important opinion piece on climate change and the market's role in helping fight it. The CFTC reinstated Terra Exchange LLC as a swap execution facility. The FTSE Mondo Visioni Exchanges Index burst through the 70,000 point mark today on Monday, the 31st of August, ending the day at a closing all-time high of 70,221.41. American Airlines and Delta Airlines matched United Airlines' move to eliminate change fees for flights. Good news, but I'm not sure when I will fly again, or change flights for that matter. A happy belated birthday to Walter Thomas Tom Price III, who turned 80 on August 30th. Tom is the founder of the Price Group and my former employer. He is a mentor from whom I learned much. He allowed me to use those lessons and incubate John J. Lothian and Company in the offices of the Price Group and help turn it into what it is today. He is one of the kindest persons I have ever known. Happy birthday, Tom. The barbershop in the building adjacent to the SIBO, J.R. Lala, has closed for good. I used this barber shop since the 1980s when it was in the broker's building. This is from Sarah Rudolph, editor-in-chief of John Lothian News. The Security Traders Association, the STA, is holding its 2020 Market Structure Conference virtually from October 7th to 8th with a focus on listed options. It will kick off with a fireside chat between CBOE Global Markets Chairman, President, and CEO Ed Tilley and CBOE Executive Vice President, Head of Markets Brian Harkins. The registration fee is $295 per person, but employees of government agencies and sponsoring firms attend for no cost. Firms interested in sponsoring must be confirmed by Tuesday, September 8th.
And now, first read. Episode 5 of the JLN podcast, The Botanicals, came out, and you can listen to it at johnlothiannews.com. This episode is entitled Chicago Normal, Social Equity Licenses Just the Start. Stephen Simpson, Executive Secretary of the Cannabis Advocacy Group, Chicago Normal, spoke with John Lothian News about the group's social equity agenda and why the imminent awarding of 75 new dispensary licenses is just one item on a long checklist.
As mentioned before, the FIA today published a new policy paper in consultation with its members across the clear derivatives industry on climate-related risks for financial markets and the global economy. The paper, How Derivative Markets Are Helping the World Fight Climate Change, focuses on how the industry is already addressing this issue and highlights potential partnerships with the public sector to help build a more sustainable economy in the long run. FTSE Russell has a story that U.S. equity markets have made a steady climb in recent months. Notable gains in the U.S. large cap Russell 1000 index and the U.S. small cap Russell 2000 index in July and August. Isabella Kaminsky from the Financial Times has a story about Dungeons and Dragons and the group QAnon. A strange subset of geek culture is threatening to destabilize society by taking over the internet and blurring the line between reality and fantasy. A type of online information warfare. Its objective is to sow discord and distrust. Yet it is masquerading as a live-action role-playing game, or LARP, and much of the population doesn't even know it is happening. This is a headline from Zara Sang's story from The Atlantic, America is Running Low on Monkeys. In the past several months, more than 100 COVID-19 vaccines, therapies, and drugs have been pushed into development. But for any of these treatments to make it to humans, they usually have to face another animal first, a monkey. And here, scientists in the United States are facing a bottleneck. There just are not enough monkeys to go around. My comment was, you used to be able to buy monkeys by the barrel. What happened? Here are the top three stories from yesterday's John Lothian newsletter. Our top story Monday was my story, One Chicago to Close on September 18th for trading, Long Live One Chicago. Second was Don Wilson changes course on Gold Coast Landmark from Crane Chicago Business. That story has appeared a couple times in the most read stories. Third was John Lothian, that would be me, my other commentary, One Chicago and Single Stock Futures helped make the John Lothian newsletter. This is John Lothian with the commentary and stories from the first read section of the John Lothian newsletter for September 2nd, 2020. The tribute page to the late Richard Schaefer has been updated to include one from Mary Bergonia Ross, a good friend from the NYMEX. I met Mary as Mary Bergonia when she ran the Chicago office of Mann Financial. Her remembrance starts with this. Richie was a dear friend, a formidable competitor, and a fearless leader for all of us at NYMEX. My first memory of Richie is handing him a rather large heating oil order to execute in the earliest illiquid days of the contract in the early 80s. Scott Johnston is out at Citadel, where he was chief administrative officer. His LinkedIn status says his new job is, quote, non-compete period at Citadel, unquote. Johnston is a former CIO of the CME, among other industry positions. When I first met Scott, he was at the CME, and I was running the electronic trading division of the Price Group. I felt like he downloaded my brain over lunch. He was so inquisitive, looking for problems to fix with the CME electronic trading. I learned something very important from him. Problems are opportunities. They are opportunities to solve the problem and make things better, and that is a good thing. He had a great attitude. Ted Sturial has joined CloudQuant as Vice President of Sales. In another closing in the Chicago Financial District of a small business, the bar Cactus Club is closing after 31 years. The bar was a block away and kitty quarter from the Chicago Board of Trade building. It was next to Cal's Liquors for many years. Here are some of the product highlights from the CME's August volume update. CME Group had record metals average daily volume, or ADV, of 15% from August 2019, including record silver ADV of 221,000 contracts, up 61% from August 2019. Record micro gold futures ADV of 194,000 contracts, up 380% from August of 2019, and record micro silver ADV of 34,000 contracts, up 1,000% from August 2019. They had record 3-year treasury note futures trading volume of 13,401 contracts on August 31st. The micro e-mini equity futures ADV grew 72% from August 2019, while the options on the micro e-mini S&P and micro e-mini NASDAQ 100 futures launched August 31st traded a combined 1,815 contracts on day one. The natural gas options ADV at the CME rose 53% from August 2019, and soybean futures ADV grew 23% from August 2019. Lastly, the CME's SONIA futures ADV grew 22% from August 2019, and their wheat futures ADV rose 20% from August 2019. The Minneapolis Grain Exchange had its second best month in its history, with a total monthly volume of 318,992 contracts. This past month also was the best August in exchange history, beating the previous record holder, August 2017, by nearly 7,500 contracts. August 2020 saw a 12% increase in total volume compared to August of 2019. This is the sixth consecutive August from 2015 to 2020 to hold a place in the top 25 record book for best overall month. Additionally, the calendar year-to-date total is up 17% compared to this time last year. The 100 Club is an organization in Chicago that raises money for the families of fallen first responders. They normally fund their scholarships and aid to family and students with an annual gala, which they can't hold this year due to the pandemic. Their Raising Hope 2020 program hopes to raise $400,000. Please read about this important organization and consider making a donation or becoming a member. Suzanne Cosgrove of JLN shared in First Read that the OCC reported Tuesday that total 2020 contract volume was 615,972,402 contracts, up 28.7% from 2019 and the third highest month on record. Volume gains were led by equity options. Total equity options volume was up 39.1% last month compared with 2019, with 582,394,732 contracts traded. Monthly index option volume lagged in August, down 41.8% versus August a year ago, with a total of 29,389,883 contracts. Year-to-date, OCC's average daily volume was 28,466,064 contracts. That's up 44% from August of 2019. Additional OCC volumes can be found on their website. Susanna also included a story about how the Chicago-based fintech firm AeroPay, a company that provides digital payment services to state legal cannabis businesses, and Safe Harbor Private Banking, a division of state-owned Partner Colorado Credit Union, announced a strategic partnership Tuesday. The arrangement combines AeroPay's payment technology with Safe Harbor Private Banking's compliance-based banking program for cannabis businesses. Colorado-based Safe Harbor will provide banking services for the businesses and provide transactions on the back end as part of the deal. Tom Thompson of JLN reported that according to the German press, 5 years after German Chancellor Angela Merkel turned back criticism of her refugee policy, saying, "Wir schaffen das," or "we'll make it," government statistics show roughly 50% of refugees were working. Though controversial at its inception, the refugee program is now widely viewed as a success in integrating new workers into the workforce. Employed refugees are, however, more vulnerable to layoffs and dismissals resulting from the coronavirus pandemic, says a recent report from the Institute for Career and Employment Research. A Bloomberg story titled "Trader Fat Finger Blamed for Accidentally Selling 5 Million Company Shares" told the details of how a sale was made by a trader managing chairman's account. Li Dongshen issued an apology Wednesday on social media. Here's the first part of the story. The chairman of TCL Technology Group Corp. said a trader accidentally sold 5 million shares using his account, an incident that comes as the stock nears record high. The sale was made at 1:03 p.m. Tuesday by a trader managing chairman Li Dongshen's accounts who had typed in the wrong stock code. The Guangdong-based panel maker said in a filing to the Shenzhen exchange, Li bought back the shares for 35.8 million yuan, or $5.2 million, less than the 2 hours after the trader sold them for 35.9 million yuan, the firm said. He will hand over the profits from the trade to the company, the statement ended. The New York Times has a story, "Small business failures loom as federal aid dries up. Many owners face tough choices after a federal loan program and other government moves to bolster the economy have run their course. The United States faces a wave of small business failures this fall if the federal government does not provide a new round of financial assistance, a prospect that economists warn would prolong the recession, slow the recovery, and perhaps enduringly reshape the American business landscape." A Huffington Post story shares, U.S. faces a perfect storm of political violence heading into November election. There have been nearly 11,000 demonstrations in the U.S. this summer, as well as a rising tide of state repression and vigilante violence. Law enforcement and other authorities used force while intervening in nearly 400 Black Lives Matter protests since police killed George Floyd in May, according to new data that paints the clearest portrait yet of the historic unrest that swept the U.S. this summer. Here's the top three stories from the John Lothian newsletter from Tuesday. Number one was, markets need to be part of climate change solution, says FIA, a new policy paper on sustainability from the Futures Industry Association in consultation with its members. Second was, a robot to suppress bogus traders is in the works in South Korea, from Bloomberg. Third was, the Financial Times QAnon lures adherents by acting like a game. MarketsWiki had 186,744,309 pages viewed as of this morning, with 24,421 pages on the site and 225,924 edits. This is John Lothian with the commentary and stories from the first read section of the John Lothian newsletter for September 3rd, 2020. Chris Brummer, the Agnes N. Williams Research Professor at the Georgetown University Law Center, led a virtual panel discussion yesterday titled, "What Does the Data Reveal About the Absence of Black Financial Regulators?" The panel discussed a paper that researched the subject and found that, quote, "The historical data indicate that there have been a total of 327 individuals appointed to financial regulatory agencies. Of that total, 10 have been black." Former CFTC Commissioner Sharon Bowen was on the panel and was one of the 10 black regulators listed. The Wall Street Journal has an online story titled, How to Stop Eye Strain When You Relentlessly Stare at Screens, by Ashley Mateo. This is an important subject, as I know my eyes hurt after I have been looking at a screen for 11 hours a day, like I did yesterday. The New York Times is reporting that the U.S. federal borrowing amid pandemic puts the U.S. debt on a path to exceed World War II. That's not a good thing. Stacy Malin, the Director of Infrastructure and Security at Vela, has a blog post titled, Marketplaces in the Cloud. It's about much more than data. The Minneapolis Grain Exchange announced it has had its second best fiscal year volume in history. MGX was recently sold to the MIAX group, so their timing was good. The great baseball pitcher Tom Seaver, one of the best pitchers ever to play the game, has died at the age of 75. Seaver died of a number of things, including COVID and dementia, but it was also tied to Lyme disease, which he contracted in 1991 and wasn't diagnosed right away, which led to the more serious problems. Sarah Rudolph, the editor-in-chief for John Lothian News, shared that Intercontinental Exchange today reported August 2020 trading volume and related revenue statistics, which you can find on Intercontinental's website. Other stories of interest from the first read section include a Bloomberg story titled New York City Warehouse Storing Million-Dollar Art to Shut Down. Manhattan's first Freeport, a windowless five-story warehouse in Harlem designed to store $2.5 billion worth of blue-chip art, is closing after 2 years. Named Arsis, which means a stronghold or citadel in Latin, the building was developed by Kera Equities at a cost of more than $40 million and includes 110,000 square foot of space and security features such as retina scanning. It was built on a lot designed as a foreign trade zone, meaning the merchandise inside isn't subject to U.S. duty or excise tax. Bloomberg also has a story titled, The Hamptons Hit Uncharted Waters. Bloomberg also has a story titled, The Hamptons Hit Uncharted Waters, $75,000 a month fall rentals. The summer season used to end on Labor Day weekend, not anymore. In the not-so-distant past, Labor Day weekend signaled the end of the Hamptons' summer season. It was called Tumbleweed Tuesday, says Richie Howe, a local realtor. You could shoot a cannon down Main Street in Southampton and not hit anyone, he said. This year is different. Also from Bloomberg, when will COVID vaccine be available? The CDC tells states to prepare for November 1st. The U.S. Center for Disease Control and Prevention has told states to prepare for a COVID vaccine to be ready by November 1st and asked them to remove obstacles that would prevent distribution sites from opening. The date suggests the federal government anticipates a vaccine will become available just days before President Donald Trump stands for re-election November 3rd, an aggressive goal that would depend on shots being tested and reviewed by then. Trump's political future hinges on the response to the virus that has killed almost 185,000 Americans. 2 days before the election, how convenient. This is about politics, not science. David Z. Morris has a blog called The Ledger, and he shared a story that's titled, HBO's new sex cult documentary has big lessons for investors. He says, when I first started writing about cryptocurrency way back in 2013, no big deal, I was above all fascinated by the potential of decentralized systems to disrupt everything we took for granted about banks, payments, and finance. But by early 2017, Ponzi schemes and other cons had begun leveraging that promise for darker ends. My own fascination increasingly expanded from the technology of crypto to the legion of operators who use techie language and hype to hoodwink victims. The top three read stories from Wednesday's John Lothian newsletter were, number one, U.S. election priced as the worst ever risk in VIX futures history, from Bloomberg. Second was the Markets Wiki page for Scott Johnson, who recently left the hedge fund Citadel. Third was JLN's Richard Schaefer Remembrances by former colleagues. It was recently updated to include a remembrance from Mary Bergonia Ross, a former executive with Mann Financial. Finally, Markets Wiki is up to 186,858,088 pages viewed, with a total of 9,059 pages on the site and 225,941 edits and counting. This is John Lothian with the commentary and stories from the first read section of the John Lothian newsletter for September 4th, 2020. Monday is Labor Day in the U.S., and John Lothian News will not be publishing an edition of JLN then. We will resume on Tuesday. Have a peaceful long weekend and reflect on our world and how you can help make it better. We all need to work harder to be loving, respectful of each other, and do our best to solve some of the many problems we currently face collectively. Wall Street had its worst performing day in months yesterday. We were overdue for a correction and headed into a three-day weekend, so it was not surprising to see some pullback. CME Group Chief Operating Officer Julie Holzrichter has an essay in LinkedIn titled "Balancing Challenges and Opportunities, Reflecting on Leading Through a Crisis with WBC." PwC is holding a webinar on how should asset managers be thinking about the upcoming LIBOR transition on Tuesday, September 15th, 2020 at 1 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. That's 12 p.m. Central Daylight Time. The sign-up link for the webinar can be found in today's JLN. The NFA has a maintenance update on their website, and the following systems may be intermittently unavailable for a brief period of time between the hours of 8 a.m. and 12 p.m. Central Time on Saturday, September 5th, 2020. Online Registration System, or ORS, Basic Data Entry, Basic, NFA Rulebook, NFA News and Notices, Security Futures Products Training, Online Payments, Online Arbitration Claims, Arbiter Profile, Arbiter Training, Employment Application and Profile System, and all electronic filing systems, including EasyFile, Exemptions, Questionnaire, and Disclosure Documents. They apologize for any inconvenience. The Wall Street Journal reported that the Hilton Hotel in Times Square in New York City is closing. The hotel will lay off 200 workers, the latest sign that New York's hospitality industry is struggling to survive during the coronavirus pandemic. Sarah Rudolph, editor-in-chief of John Lothian News, reports that Intercontinental announced Thursday that its CFO, Scott Hill, and Ellie Mae COO, Joe Tyrell, will present at the Barclays Global Financial Services Conference on Tuesday, September 15th at 11:15 Eastern Time. That's in the AM. The presentation will be available live and in replay via webcast and can be accessed in the Investor Relations and Media section of ICE's website. Sarah also shared in today's JLN that the OCC reported Thursday's market activity resulted in a new record of 7,111,658 futures contracts cleared at OCC, the fourth highest contract volume day of 45,884,033 contracts cleared completely. Social equity applicants for Illinois' new adult-use cannabis dispensing licenses were notified Thursday if they made the next round. The Illinois Department of Financial and Professional Regulation confirmed that 75 licenses will be awarded in a lottery held by IDFPR in late September. The state agency said every applicant that advanced received a perfect score in an independent evaluation of their application and also was a social equity applicant. The list is available in today's JLN. Here are some other stories from the first read section of today's JLN. The CME Group has put out a notice. There is a change to the margin parameter for customer option value aggregation. Effective with the end of day settlement cycle for Monday, September 14th, 2020, CME will switch from 90% customer net option value aggregation to 100% full net treatment option value aggregation for the determination of performance bond requirements for customers segregated, that's CSEG positions, in the base guarantee fund. My comment is this appears to be a reversal of the treatment of net option value, or NOV, at the clearinghouse. Back on May 22nd, the CME announced they planned on changing the treatment of NOV from a gross basis across all customer accounts at an FCM to a net across each customer. This would result in the CME being able to see on an account basis where the option risk is at the brokerage firm. According to an FCM executive, this would have greatly increased the amount of money the FCMs had to put up at the CME clearinghouse and reduced their profitability. From the exchange perspective, they would have greater transparency into where issues were at firms. The FCMs protested the May 22nd memo, which caused the CME to freeze the NOV level at a 10% haircut. The May 22nd memo had this moving from 10% to 100% by the end of June. Now the 10% haircut seems to have been removed. If you have some insights to share on this move from the CME on or off the record, I am glad to hear from you. The Atlantic has a story getting a lot of play on social media today. Reportedly, U.S. President Donald Trump said the Americans who died in war are losers and suckers, quote unquote. The president has repeatedly disparaged the intelligence services members and asked that wounded veterans be kept out of military parades, multiple sources tell The Atlantic. The story is by Jeff Goldberg. He reports, when President Donald Trump canceled a visit to
Ain Marna,
he blamed rain for the last-minute decision, saying the helicopter couldn't fly and that the Secret Service wouldn't drive him there. Neither claim was true. My comment is the president has denied saying Americans who died in war are losers and suckers, but the Associated Press has confirmed the Atlantic story. The AP is very good about checking and double-checking sources before they publish. The Washington Post has a story, the United States is in crisis. Report tracks thousands of summer protests, most nonviolent. About 93% of the racial justice protests that swept the United States this summer remained peaceful and non-destructive, according to a report released Thursday, with the violence and property damage that has dominated political discourse constituting only a minute portion of the thousands of demonstrations that followed the killing of George Floyd in May. My comment, there is a statistic for you, 93% of the protests this summer have been peaceful. We are peaceful people, not violent people. The protest I participated in this summer was peaceful. The Crypto Markets Wiki coin of the week is YFI. YFI, short for YEARN.finance token, garnered attention when the price of this latest DeFi wunderkind shot past Bitcoin's historic high price of just under $20,000 to trade at more than $38,000 last weekend, less than 2 months since it was launched. The token is the governance token of the Y.Finance ecosystem, which so far consists of a decentralized trading platform and an automated market maker. The token not only conveys governance rights, but also provides a share of the potential earnings, borrowing, and lending operations conducted by the YEARN.finance blockchain. The top three read stories from Thursday's John Lothian newsletter are, one was HBO's new sex cult documentary has big lessons for investors from Fortune.
The documentary refers to HBO's new documentary series, The Vow, about NXIVXM, the supposed executive success program that was actually a multi-level marketing scheme. The second most read story was the Wall Street Journal's How to Stop Eye Strain When You Relentlessly Stare at Screens. And third was If 60/40 Keeps Working, Democracy Has Failed, Paul McCulley says from Bloomberg. The Markets Wiki page of the day for yesterday was that of Sharon Y. Bowen, a former CFTC commissioner, who was a panelist Wednesday at the Brookings Institute Georgetown Law School event that explored the absence of black financial regulators. Of the 327 senior agency officials appointed through July 4, 2020, only 10 have been black. She is one of the 10. Markets Wiki has now 186,980,586 page views in 24,422 pages and 225,947 edits and counting. Have a great day, have a great weekend, stay safe, and treat people the same way you want to be treated, with respect, quality, and justice. This is John Lothian. Goodbye.